This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a new report shows that one out of every five Black prison inmates in the U.S. is serving a life sentence. Why in the world would an organization that calls itself leftist demonstrate on behalf of the former head of the FBI? And this week marks Malcolm X's 92nd birthday. But first, veteran human rights activist and 2016 Green Party vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka is busy pulling together BAP, the Black Alliance for Peace. The alliance recently issued a joint statement with UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, denouncing U.S. subversion against the socialist government of Venezuela. Baraka will be one of the speakers at UNAC's national conference in Richmond, Virginia, on June 16th through 18th. He says UNAC and the Black Alliance for Peace are a perfect fit.
The tagline of the Black Alliance for Peace is that it is a people-centered human rights project against war, repression, and imperialism. So we understand that we are, of course, committed to peace, but we understand that there can be no peace without justice. And that means that people have to be prepared to engage in struggle. So this connection, we intend to work very closely with UNAC. We are going to be at the convention or the conference in June in Richmond, June 16th. We intend to be a member of UNAC because we believe that this Black Alliance for Peace is an important, critical move, not only in terms of organizing a Black anti-war presence, but in terms of being a critical component of reviving a anti-war movement here in the U.S. So we share the objective to revive the anti-war movement, the anti-imperialist movement in the U.S., and we also are jointly connected in terms of our concerns with what is unfolding in Venezuela and the role of the U.S. state in Venezuela.
And you found a commonality with UNAC's position on the U.S. destabilization campaign against the government of Venezuela.
Exactly. And this is a concern that many of us in the Black community have had for quite some time, because a number of us have been in support and stand in solidarity with that process in Venezuela. In fact, I remember when Wesley Clark exposed the plans of the Bush administration to engage in their systematic process of destabilization and regime change. And not only was I concerned about the fact that a number of independent states in the Middle East were on that list, but we knew that as they were moving down that list, they would then move toward Latin America. And we knew that Latin America was key in terms of maintaining the progressive direction of radical revolutionary forces in the Americas and really in the world. And so we knew that Venezuela was going to be key in that process of destabilization because of the key role that that nation was playing in and still is playing in Latin America. So we was always concerned about this. And now we saw under the Obama administration that as they were shifting their focus away from their preoccupation in the Middle East, we saw a uptick in terms of the destabilization, the subversion plans that they had for Venezuela. In fact, as many of your listeners know, one of the last acts of the Obama administration was to identify Venezuela as a threat to U.S. national security. So it was just sort of the icing on the subversive cake, if you will, by this criminal regime of the Obama administration and giving further legitimacy to the activities that were then taken up by the further right-wing government of Donald Trump.
And Venezuela is now in political and economic crisis, and not just because of internal factors or even the global collapse of oil prices, but
due directly to U.S. subversive policies.
Exactly, and working in collaboration with the right-wing forces inside the country. The playbook has been quite obvious. We've seen this before in other parts of the world, where they would basically attack the population, attempt to make the conditions of the people miserable, subvert the economy, engage in activities that would create a severe situation in terms of inflation. In the case of Venezuela, of course, because of some of the imbalances in the economy, with it having to import most of its food from outside the country, that process was made easier for them to collaborate with the food import processing corporations to engage in a process of sabotage, utilizing the attempt by the Venezuelan government to make sure that everybody had access to food, and therefore there was a process of heavily subsidizing food in Venezuela, and you have basically a dual economy, and that allowed for those internal forces to basically subvert that process, create artificial shortages, move products to the black market, and we saw the result. The result being these food lines and food shortages and all of that. And part of the propaganda process, of course, then is to point to this as the failures of socialism. And with this kind of pressure on the population, then you ratchet up the political pressure. You use some of the weaker points internally, particularly the student sector, and you begin a process of agitation. And then you spark a response from the state, and then you point to that response as further evidence of its repressive nature, and we've seen the playbook. And then, you know, you have this political movement inside the U.S. Congress to then suggest that Venezuela is anti-democratic and that the champions of democracy, that is the U.S., then have a moral responsibility to intervene.
Yes, well, it's not just the official organs of the United States government that are arrayed against the government of Venezuela, but also the corporate media, which constantly calls Venezuela some kind of authoritarian dictatorship, although they've had many elections and elections that have been called almost universally by objective observers free and fair since 1998, and have allowed people who participated in the 2002 attempted coup to still take part in public life.
Even Jimmy Carter in the Carter Center has commented that the elections in Venezuela have been free and fair. In fact, some of the fairest and freest in the world. So this whole notion of Venezuela being a dictatorship is part of the propaganda process. Any state that attempts to try to exercise its political independence is characterized as a dictatorship by the capitalist dictatorship in the U.S. So, you know, we've seen this. I had a chance myself to witness firsthand the election process a few years ago as an international observer for the national elections, regional elections. And I've observed elections before with the Carter Center and other formations in other parts of the world. And I could attest from my firsthand observations that the process, of course, was in fact free and open. But we know that's par for the course. That's part of the propaganda process. I mean, and so now we have a situation where you have the U.S. Congress involved in undermining the democratic process in Venezuela. Marco Rubio introduced a bill a week or so ago calling for the U.S. to set aside millions of dollars for regime change in Venezuela. In fact, as a consequence of the U.S. identifying Venezuela as a threat to national security, regime change now is back on the agenda as official U.S. policy, and we're seeing the consequences of that. And that's why we felt it was important to issue this statement, to bring attention to what's happening in Venezuela, but also to signal that those of us who are part of the black community and part of our commitment to stand in solidarity with struggling people and people who are struggling against national oppression, that it's time for us to make sure that our voices are heard and we're going to be in opposition to these attempts to try to undermine Venezuela. We know and we work with our counterparts in Venezuela, and people have to be reminded constantly that when we talk about the Americas and we talk about social justice and social change in the Americas. We're talking about situations and processes that impact up to 200 million black folks. So we have skin in the game, if you will. And so we say it's important for us to make sure that people in the U.S., in particular black folks, understand the importance of Venezuela because of its importance in the revolutionary processes in the Americas.
Yes, in your joint statement, you talk about support for Venezuela being in line with the longstanding black radical tradition of defending nations under imperialist attack by the U.S. government. But this is also in line with reciprocity. Venezuela has taken numerous actions of solidarity with folks in the United States.
Exactly. And some of the most obvious ones we have to remind people of is, for example, right after Katrina tragedy, the Venezuelans were prepared to offer us assistance. That assistance was rejected by the Bush administration. We know that we have worked very closely with various elements from Venezuela, providing heating assistance to various communities inside the U.S. They had a project where they were providing free electric bulbs and this and that to low-income communities in the U.S. So these connections are very close and intimate, and it is part of the black radical tradition to be in solidarity with those nations that are attempting to maintain their political independence, who are still trying to maintain their national sovereignty, even as they find themselves in the crosshairs of U.S. imperialism. So this is part of our task with this Black Alliance of Peace, is to remind folks of those responsibilities and to organize and galvanize progressive black forces to reconnect up with that tradition and to become even more forthright and aggressive in our solidarity responsibilities. And like you said, solidarity is a two-way street. So we are in solidarity with those nations and peoples who are also in solidarity with our struggles, understanding the commonalities of those struggles, because we have all been oppressed by the same common oppressive forces.
And even more specifically, we must note that there are racial aspects to the conflict in Venezuela, as can be readily seen by the differing complexions among the competing demonstrators and the very whiteness of the Venezuelan elite.
Exactly. And the whiteness and the class component. I mean, we have in Venezuela the intensification of class struggle, but that class struggle, of course, is informed also by race. Because as in most societies in the Americas, including the U.S., and sometimes we forget that the U.S. is part of the so-called Americas, the folks who end up on the bottom of society's ladder are those people of color. And in particular, you have black folks at the bottom. So, yes, there's a clear class and race contradiction in that country. And that's why it's understandable that the U.S. would side with the racialized elite, the white elite, in Venezuela, who are attempting to try to turn back the hands of time and to reverse the progress that's been made over the years in Venezuela. I mean, look, before the downturn of the economy, we had a situation in Venezuela where the government, the revolutionary process, was making progress in terms of improving the lives of millions of people in that country. That's why it's been very difficult for the U.S. to undermine completely the revolutionary process. You had hundreds of thousands of new dwellings being offered to Venezuelan people. You have the expansion of education. And we went from 12 universities in 1998 to 32 today. You've had them to significantly reduce malnutrition. You've had an improvement in the level of people who are officially living in poverty. So there's been significant social advances, and those advances help to explain why you have this difference in terms of the complexion of the people in the streets. You have more of the so-called people of color and black folks who are still in solidarity and supporting the government, and you have all of these lighter-skinned people and white folks from the middle class and bourgeoisie class that are in the streets undermining the governmental process. Of course, you have people of color involved also, too, because, you know, with the kind of money that's being disseminated to undermine the government, it's very easy, and that's part of the playbook also, to hire people to engage in some of the subversive activities we've seen them engage in inside the country, including
murder. We have these armed thugs that are working with the opposition, and they have been responsible for most of the killings that have taken place inside the country. That's part of the process, but we have to remind people that what we are seeing is, in fact, a class and race struggle in Venezuela.
President Maduro has called for a constitutional kind of convention. Might we expect that steps will be taken to rein in the elite's control over the economy and especially the distribution of consumer goods coming out of that convention?
Well, you know, the opposition, and of course, one of the leaders of the opposition came to the U.S. Last week. They have indicated that they have no interest in any kind of process like that. They have been told that there's going to be a drive toward regime change. Therefore, any kind of political or diplomatic, if you will, solution is not something that they are interested in. They are prepared to struggle all the way. And I think that the United Socialist Party and the state of Venezuela need to understand that this, in fact, is going to be a struggle for power, a struggle to maintain the integrity of that process. And so they just have to be prepared for that, because with this right-wing government in the U.S. and those forces inside Venezuela, they believe that they have the balance of forces in their favor, and they're going to drive toward a resolution that's going to be in their favor. If we've seen what happened in Brazil, of course, the situation in Venezuela is much different because Brazil, of course, you had a coup, a constitutional coup, if you will. But the Workers' Party in Brazil, because of their embracing of neoliberalism, made significant mistakes and basically undermined their social base, which, you know, made them vulnerable for that coup. We don't have that situation in Venezuela. While there's been some drop off in support, there's still significant sectors. The majority, as a matter of fact, of the people in Venezuela who are still in support of this process. So it's going to be a struggle. You know, who comes out on top is really going to be a reflection of the political will of those forces.
And in Venezuela, the right-wing opposition, some figures in the right-wing opposition, elected figures in that opposition, have repeatedly called for intervention by the Venezuelan military, called for a coup, and yet they're allowed to walk the streets and vote in the legislature.
Exactly. The U.S. state is prepared to support that, and not only are they prepared to support a coup, they are prepared to use military force even in more obvious ways. I mean, you know, we have to keep putting this situation in Venezuela within regional context. The U.S. state sees Venezuela as key to reversing the progress made throughout the Americas, in particular in South America. So it's not just about Venezuela, but it's also about Bolivia and Ecuador. And they are prepared to use military force to, in fact, reverse the process. For example, Donald Trump talked about NATO being obsolete. He was educated on the real role of NATO. And you have a situation now, Glenn, where you have NATO in Latin America. In Colombia and Peru, they are going to be organizing a NATO project where there's going to be joint drillings, military drilling between Brazil, Colombia, and Peru, something that is completely unprecedented for Latin America in more than 100 years. So this is what the so-called NATO project is all about. This is not just some kind of military entity that's concerned with Europe and the Russians. This has been and is an instrument of Euro and U.S. imperialism that's used to maintain global white supremacy. So they are prepared to use their military in Latin America directly, and they're preparing their vassal states for that. And with the possibility of a further right-wing government emerging in Colombia, and with this right-wing government in the U.S., it doesn't bode well for the region in terms of being able to escape more intense direct violence.
So Venezuela richly deserves the attention of the U.S. anti-war movement.
It deserves the attention. It deserves to be prioritized. If you are really committed to seeing progressive social change in the global South, that this has to be, I think, the number one priority at this point, to back the U.S. off of its plans for Venezuela. Again, as I said, You know, you have this move in the U.S. Senate. You have the cooperation, as you pointed out, from the corporate press. And you have the collaboration through silence, but also through active participation of this confused bourgeois left that is, in fact, collaborating with these efforts because of this boogeyman of authoritarianism in Venezuela, this liberal framework that these forces bring to their view of the world. And so, therefore, they have not been as aggressive as they should be and need to be in standing in principled solidarity with this process, no matter what its internal issues or contradictions might be, that if they're really committed to shifting the balance of power more toward the people than imperialism, then Venezuela will have to be and should be really the number one priority.
And the number one priority of anti-war movements in the U.S. should be the sovereignty of other countries.
It should be. But as we know, this has not been their thrust, particularly in the last 10 years or so. And I think part of that is connected to the ideological shift that occurred as a consequence of Obama and other kinds of innovative creations by the propaganda arm of the U.S. state in collaboration with the media, with humanitarian interventions and the responsibility to protect, and playing on the sort of liberal ideological foundation of many people in this country. They found a way, a tool to use to split the left and radical movement in the U.S., appealing to their liberal sort of anti-reflexive, anti-authoritarianism. So it's a situation that one would think would be a priority for leftists and for radicals in terms of protecting national sovereignty, but that is no longer the case. If these countries are characterized as so-called authoritarian governments, then the left has been silent while the U.S. has engaged in its subversive plans to undermine those governments. And to me, it's so absurd in the sense that if you look at these things, and these folks engage in all these this kind of absolute moralism, if you have any understanding of the U.S. history and the U.S. state, the very fact that the U.S. would be opposed to a state should suggest to you that there has to be something to that besides what you think it is. That is, when has the U.S. ever been on the side of a morality and principles? So it's really been a really odd and absurd situation with the left in the U.S.
Ajamu Baraka is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition says Donald Trump's victory has caused great confusion in the land as we witness the spectacle of people that call themselves leftists demonstrating in support of James Comey, the recently fired head of the FBI.
These are strange times. There's enormous crisis in the top ruling circles. And it's a time when we need to anchor ourselves in the things that we know. That is the FBI, the CIA. These are national police intelligence agencies. So there's a fight going on in the ruling circles as to how far the FBI should go. But it was disheartening to see left forces so anxious to combat Trump actually supporting Comey. So I think when I say an anchor, anchoring ourselves in what we know and not applauding when the acting director of the FBI, McCabe, says, you can't stop the men and women of the FBI from doing the right thing. And then this is applauded. No, we have to be clear. All of these agencies are about absolute repression, subversion, assassinations, everything that they can do destructive to the working class and progressive movement in the U.S. and internationally. And if we have that anchor, then we can understand there's a big crisis unfolding. It doesn't have to do with Trump as a personality, but the increasing crisis that U.S. imperialism is facing on a global scale and also facing in terms of a capitalist system that is in complete disarray. And just to address a couple of those things, I wanted to talk about this stunning reversal of the U.S. being challenged in South Korea and also a little bit about the restructuring that's going on in retail right now. tens of thousands of layoffs, and the kind of thing that that means, because there are real crises ahead of us, and they're bigger crises than just Trump, the fascist demagogue that he is, no doubt about it. But the crisis, the system as a whole is in crisis.
Yes, during this whole time that Trump was threatening Korea, the U.S. corporate media said almost nothing about the fact that there was a Korean election underway. And it appeared almost certain that a lefter candidate who favored rapprochement and negotiations with the North and who opposed the U.S. anti-missile system would win the election. But there was not even any talk about that in the United States.
No, the entire talk of the corporate media, and for a reason, time and again, the U.S. has been able to sway and impact elections in South Korea and push them to the right by creating a crisis with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea in the North. And they push it to the max. They even announced aircraft carriers were steaming toward North Korea. That turned out to be a total fraud. But all of this, the push to place the THAAD missiles in place before the election, all of it was to create an absolute crisis in South Korea. And the fact that it absolutely failed, and there's a stunning reversal with the election of the most progressive candidate, he's a liberal Democrat, but President Moon Jae-in, this is a big, big development, because the right wing, totally pro-U.S., President Park was impeached, and there is a movement from below, a mass workers' movement, that is not being covered here at all. But there were massive demonstrations of millions of people. There were general strikes. There were shutdowns that were called, and they were organized by the South Korean trade union movement. This was not just a struggle in the ruling circles. It was pushed from below. And even after the impeachment of Park, that's when the U.S. pushed full bore in trying to create this crisis and push it back to the right. It totally failed. It is a pretty stunning reversal. And in the South, there is a real push going on now for systematic change, for challenges of big corporate power that's in, you know, a few families hold all the strings. There's a call for a new sunshine policy of engagement with the North, thinking that was the term that was used in 2000 when the last progressive candidates were in the South, about 2008, I believe. So this crisis has been turned around. It's a big smack in the face. Similar thing has happened in the Philippines. The whole idea of a pivot to Asia and locking down through missile batteries, through militarism, is being pushed back by people's movements. And not dependent on the politicians who are elected, but there's growing agitation against U.S. war threats. And it's important to recognize from here, because it's hardly a line of coverage is happening about it.
And what you just described was, of course, massive meddling by the United States in the politics and the elections of another country. But that's a non-story here.
That absolutely is. Instead, the only story we hear is trying to blame Russia for an election reversal that wasn't expected here, when there was real opposition to and passivity, an unwillingness to push forward for the Clinton election, which was expected and was reversed. So while they can blame it on Russia, and they do every single day, this is absolutely U.S. policy to every country in the world of trying to not only influence elections, do so through their media, but do so also through aircraft carriers, through threats of nuclear war. And it's done time and time again. But people also learn, and mass movements learn, and they refuse to be cowed again and again. So there's a high-level crisis that's going on, and U.S. militarism is increasingly finding itself unable to solve any of the problems it's created. Here they are talking about still more troops to Afghanistan, by far the longest war in U.S. history, no end in sight, 16 years and running. And they find that there's nowhere secure in the poorest country on the face of the earth, the country most destroyed by U.S. wars, and they find no way out because they haven't secured a country which is pivotal to them in Central Asia, very important in terms of positioning next to Iran, important in terms of Pakistan, important in terms of the entire region, and no security. The same thing in Syria. No security in U.S. war plans. They try to play Turkey against the Kurds, against Iraq. There's so many irons in the fire. For the people of the region, it means complete devastation, horrendous loss of life, millions of people uprooted. But it has not secured U.S. stability. And I think it's an important time for us to focus on U.S. imperialism and not be caught up with supporting this or that police agency or this or that U.S. puppet or U.S. created force. There's a great deal of confusion created around Syria, where people actually of supposedly the left find themselves in support of forces who are clearly aligned with U.S. objectives. So clarity and focus, I think, will very much be part of the United National Anti-War Conference taking place in Richmond in mid-June. A number of the workshops and speakers, panelists, are going to be talking about U.S. war globally and U.S. increased repression at home, expressing both the deep solidarity with the immigrant and Muslim movements right here that are so under attack, and having a consistent view on opposition to U.S. wars.
Yes, the job of the anti-war activist is to curtail the warmongering of their own country, not to go around policing the politics of the rest of the world.
That's exactly right. I mean, if ever there was a time to say U.S. hands off the world, and also to say to the police and intelligence agencies right here, hands off, a consistent, clear view can be an important anchor in a time when there's great, great instability coming ahead of us. Just to even say, I just wanted to mention, because it's becoming so clear, sort of the next crisis of the capitalist system here at home, where Trump has made big promises how he's going to save and bring back jobs. But there is a huge restructuring going on in retail industries, where there's tens of thousands of layoffs in the last 6 months. About 90,000 people laid off from major chains. We're talking about Penny's and Macy's and Sears and Kane. There is a shakeup going on in shopping malls closing down across the country, because when the big chains go under, along with them go the fast food and the security workers and the maintenance workers and those who handle the displays and every aspect of this. Why are the layoffs? It's being driven by internet technology and online shopping, but it impacts tens of thousands, really hundreds of thousands of workers right here. And it's just the beginning, because there was a huge bubble in retail and shopping malls, just like there was a housing bubble. But now that bubble is coming increasingly clear, and it has a real impact in terms of how the capitalist system functions. These are low-wage, really minimum-wage jobs, and they're being slashed in the tens of thousands.
And folks thought they could depend on them because these were not the kinds of jobs that could be outsourced. And we were supposed to reconcile ourselves to the loss of manufacturing because, well, we had service and we had retail.
That's exactly how it was sold, that increasingly the U.S. economy would be a service economy, that retail stores would forever grow and expand, that all these franchises were the future. And what we see is that's the way they talk up a bubble, and then the bubble breaks, the bubble bursts, because they establish far more of these franchises and businesses that can operate at a profit. Not more than maybe could exist in another world or another time, but certainly more than can exist in a capitalist system, which must always make a profit. Doesn't matter how many people get laid off, whole cities, little towns that dry up because these very larger franchises have wiped out lots and lots of small businesses that they in turn also go under. So these are the crises that are in store right here. Important for us to have in the back of our mind when we're looking at how ruthless increasingly U.S. imperialism is becoming abroad. And it is because their options here at home are smaller and smaller than at any time.
And the more crises, the more reasons that the rulers have to seek diversions. Look over here, look over there. Don't look where your job used to be.
That's so true. But it is also a time for us to know that there is great potential for struggle, for organizing, and that increasingly young people are radicalized in ways that they are against the system itself. They're anti-capitalist to the core. It's expressed in spontaneous, almost instantaneous demonstrations. And yet it's an important time that we not allow that movement to be just dragged in another direction, dragged against Russia or China, or dragged into a war, dragged into a new propaganda offensive. But it is among a whole generation, those who see no future for themselves in this system and no interest in wider war.
Well, there certainly is no future for the left in organizing demonstrations for FBI directors and such.
Isn't that true? Right. I mean, that was just one small example. And yet, when you see it happening, you think, gee, let's be really clear who the FBI is, what the CIA is, what all of these police agencies are, and what both political parties are, Republican and Democrat, are really all about administering the empire. So the struggle against Trump has to go deeper and understand it as both political parties playing a criminal role in the world and in the U.S. today.
Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition. A new report by the Washington-based Sentencing Project shows that one out of every seven prisoners in the United States is serving a life sentence. Lifers make up one out of every five black prison inmates. More and more, prisons are places for warehousing old people, the legacy of a lock-em-up and throw-away-the-key criminal justice system that has abandoned all pretense of rehabilitation. We spoke with Ashley Nellis, senior research analyst for the Sentencing Project.
There definitely is a sense about these policies that certain individuals are beyond redemption or beyond any reform abilities. And so that's why we see life sentences continue to accumulate. But there's a large body of criminological research that suggests that they are able to reform and redeem, and that most people, even those who commit serious offenses, tend to age out. They mature out of bad behavior by their 20s and 30s. So incarcerating them for decades past that point serves no public safety benefit. And there are other reasons to incarcerate people, but our system is based on incarceration being to serve public safety and also apply some form of punishment, but that punishment is not the only goal of incarceration.
It seems to go beyond public safety in terms of who gets punished hardest and most often. Seven of the states, according to the reports, have lifer populations that are two-thirds black.
Right. And in certain states, Maryland is the lead in this. Near far more than half of the population is African American, and three quarters is composed of people of color. But in New Jersey, it's about 62% are African American. And the reason that this does not come out as very high in terms of parity compared to the overall prison population is that New Jersey leads the country in its over-incarceration of African Americans for all crimes, not just life sentences. So New Jersey has a disparity ratio of 12-1 when it comes to black-white disparity in general incarceration. And then with lifers, 1 in 10 African American prisoners is serving a life sentence in New Jersey.
You were speaking of people aging out of a tendency towards a violent crime, but that doesn't match prison policy. You age out of that demographic, but you don't age out of prison.
Correct. Right. So over the past several decades, states have tried to extend sentences, even though there's quite a bit of evidence that the severity of the sentence is not nearly as influential on public safety as the certainty of it. And so to make sentences 20 years longer, just to try to serve as a deterrent effect, there's no empirical support for that strategy. But what that does do is put a burden on states in terms of having to house and feed and provide health services to folks well beyond their tendency or even their physical ability to commit crime.
And you report that there are 12,000 prisoners who are serving life sentences for crimes that were committed when they were teenagers, folks who don't even think about what they might be doing or where they might be living at the age of 60 or 65.
Right. And that's important because the Supreme Court has come down several times now and said that juveniles are different, that children are different when it comes to their ability to comprehend the gravity of their actions, their ability to cope with childhood events and circumstances that have shaped them up until that point, and also on the brighter side, their ability to reform their lives and to be fully rehabilitated because they are not complete human beings yet when they're still teenagers.
You give President Obama some credit for issuing thousands of commutations, although when compared to the hugeness of the U.S. prison population, that really doesn't amount to much.
Well, I mean, President Obama was only able to do so much. He can only, you know, work within the federal system. You know, he can't solve mass incarceration as a president. And so he did a lot. He accomplished a lot, and he did grant a clemency to as many as he possibly could. The problem is that there are thousands of people in the federal system who are serving life sentences for nonviolent crimes, a large percentage of which are there just for drug crimes alone. And you don't see that in any state in the country, only in the federal system.
You say that he did as much as he possibly could, but even these clemency rules are governed by guidelines that I believe are within the Justice Department and the Bureau of Prisons that are not set in stone by law, and that, for example, require keeping people in prison for 10 years of their sentence for certain drug crimes if committed with violence.
Right, correct, yeah. So there were definitely a lot of restrictions on the people who might otherwise be eligible for clemency for a drug offense. And so I think that he and, you know, I don't know too much about the work, but I know a fair amount that Obama and the Pardons Office, they worked closely together to try to find the best cases that would have the best outcome. And, you know, it could have been broader for sure. But they worked under a limited time and they worked with, you know, sort of limited support. So they had to start with the most narrow and then work their way out in the short time that he had to do this.
You described President Trump and Attorney General Sessions as being, you use these words, more hesitant on these issues. Those are some diplomatic terms, more hesitant.
Well, neither of them have spoken out about life sentences and where we should go with life sentences. But they're, so far, the policies from the administration, the tone, let's say, of the administration has not been encouraging in terms of advancing criminal justice reforms. But the hope is that, you know, that there will be some movement. It's extremely hard to make progress on criminal justice reform. We're less optimistic in this administration than we were in the last. I don't expect that any reform to life sentences will be made at the federal level, but would always welcome that idea.
As many people have said, that a kind of consensus had developed over the past 20 years, in fact, with even conservative Republicans joining with more progressive Democrats with the aim of dramatically reducing the prison population. But you seem to think that President Trump and Attorney General Sessions are not part of that consensus.
Right. No, they're definitely not. But the good news is that most of the progress that has been made has been at the state level. And we expect and we hope and we work toward keeping that ball rolling. Most of the decarceration efforts have been made at the state level. States like New Jersey, for instance, New York, California have made considerable declines in their prison population. And there's no reason to expect that those sorts of reforms should cease or even slow down when the federal level folks are changing their tone. The states know what to do. The states feel the day-to-day budget crunch. They know that their constituents support more level-headed approaches to criminal justice and that these ideas about tough and crime and law and order and all these are outdated. They've been tried and they've been proven to fail.
So all of the law and order bombast from the Trump federal government does not automatically have a huge impact at the state level.
Right. It doesn't have to. You know, the states have a lot to work with. Crime is down for the most part. Budgets are tight. People are supportive of taking a second look at who's in our prisons and why they're there and for how long they're there and looking for alternatives. And so far, those efforts, when they've been tried, have worked out. So there's a lot of political cover, as they say. The life sentences are continuing to grow while we're seeing reforms to criminal justice. In a lot of areas, we're not seeing a willingness to discuss those at the deep end of the system. And those are really the most expensive and in some ways the least dangerous, despite the seriousness of their original offense. The hope is that with these data, armed with these data and this report, that states will try to bring into the conversation those serving life and long-term sentences when they're discussing reforms.
That was Ashley Nellis of the Sentencing Project in Washington. Mumia Abu-Jamal is the nation's best-known political prisoner. Abu-Jamal was an accomplished journalist before his conviction in the death of a Philadelphia policeman. Mumia presented this essay for Prison Radio on neoliberal utopias and nightmares.
Acclaimed science fiction writer Ursula Le Guin, in her book The Ones Who Walk Away from Amelas, crafts a tale that crackles with the electricity of life. This is not a book review, nor really a review of the sci-fi novel, for in truth, I've not read it. But I have read the introduction of scholar-philosopher Elizabeth Povinelli. Her work is entitled Economies of Abandonment, the title of which is telling. It's the child in the broom closet. There is a child living in a dark, fetid broom closet in the city of Omelas. She's covered in sores and filth and waste. And everyone in Omelas knows this. And all of Omelas is happy. They go about their lives, their work, their play, with the silent knowledge of this child's intense and unremitting suffering. Indeed, Povinelli suggests that Omela's happiness rests upon the suffering of this tortured, miserable, lonely child. She is naked and beaten and unloved. For when some sensitive soul feels this rank injustice, their hot tears cool and dry under the simple, icy reality that this is just the way things are in Omela's. Some quietly leave this city of happiness, burdened by the knowledge of this bitter cruelty. Povinelli uses Le Guin's fictional creation to examine our present reality under what she terms late liberalism or neoliberalism. By this she means the social-political project of almost unchecked capital accumulation, while raiding the public commons for private gain, such as the state's elevation of private schools during the concomitant abandonment of public schools. In a nutshell, neoliberalism means the triumph of the market over all other social values. What does this mean when we think of the battered and bruised child in the broom closet? The neoliberal Clinton era that began with executions and ended with the consolidation of mass incarceration also featured the unprecedented prosecutorial, judicial, philosophical attack on children dubbed vicious super predators by Hillary Clinton, who, her words, needed to be brought to heel. It is noteworthy, therefore, that Pennsylvania, the site of the greatest number of juvenile lifers on earth, reflected the loss of votes for Clinton in two discrete populations, about 1% less black votes than Obama received, and an overwhelming number of prison guards who voted for Trump, despite the fact that President Clinton was most responsible for this prison jobs and this prison boom by sending billions of dollars to states to build new prisons in his notorious 1994 crime bill. Like the tortured child in the broom closet, children were cast into the hells of adult prison, while the newly rich neoliberal class drank champagne and enjoyed the good life. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Malcolm X would have turned 92 years of age this week if he'd not been cut down by assassins. The event will be marked in many places, including the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Educational and Memorial Center in New York City. Imam Talib Abdul Rashad is a member of the center's advisory board. He says the event is titled, What Malcolm Means to Us.
The legacy of Malcolm X is extremely important because there exists now in the public narrative or in public discourse what I refer to as a homogenized version of Malcolm X that does not present accurately who he was and his impact today. Let me give you one example. Oftentimes today when you hear Al-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, mentioned on television programs, in well-meaning commentary, they will refer to him as, quote, a civil rights leader of the 1960s. But Malcolm X was not a civil rights leader, and he used to make it clear in his speeches and in his interviews that he was not a civil rights leader, but rather a human rights leader. And so this one clarification helps us to understand his impact. Like many great leaders, Malcolm X was a visionary leader. And that is to say that the things that he was doing 50 years ago, the things that he was saying, the direction that he was pointing in with his activist work and his leadership are relevant now. Today's generation, the Black Lives Matter generation, are constantly going to YouTube, viewing Malcolm X videos and speeches, because what he was saying 50 years ago is just as relevant today as it was then.
Yes, and at the Shabazz Center, the events that are held oftentimes have representation from a wide range of demographics, particularly with respect to age. What do you think it is about El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz that allows for the kinds of intergenerational dialogues that often occur up at the Shabazz Center?
He stood on a platform, an uncompromising platform of truth and sincerity and courage, moral courage, and fearlessness. And this is something that appeals to people regardless of their age. And so when we entitle our upcoming celebration, What Malcolm X Means to Us, we felt that that would give an opportunity for a cross-generation of people to speak and to give testimonials. So you'll have elders speaking who were young people when Malcolm X was young, and you will have younger generation leaders who are involved now who weren't even born when Malcolm was on the scene, and all of them will be able to give personal testimony as to the impact of a Hajj Malik Malcolm X on their lives and on their work. I've had the honor several times over the years to MC or to co-MC these programs, and I always ask the audience, how many of you here are here for the first time? And there are always several people who raise their hands. And then I say to them that we hope that this will be your first time, not your last time. So the first thing that we hope people will take away from the event will be a desire to come back for other programs during the year and to look at our educational kiosk to stay tuned in. The second thing is, as I said, this event is to be an inspirational and celebrational event. So we hope that people will walk away from this event inspired, motivated to struggle for freedom, justice, and equality, just as Malcolm X did.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.